Good morning. This is Larry Warren, and welcome to Mountain Money, using some NPR theme music this morning to get the day started. And looking like a great day out here. 80 degrees expected for the high today, with partly cloudy skies, about a 20% chance of rain after a spectacular weekend, Doug, with lots going on. Doug Wells joining as usual.
Good morning. Yeah, there's certainly no shortage of fun activities in Park City.
Yeah, 10,000 people on Main Street, quite the finish for the tour of Utah, and Park City showing itself to the world well once again, as we do so often. Well, we have an interesting show this morning. We're going to start by talking with Paul Shoemaker, and Paul is an author, has written the book Can't Not Do, The Compelling Social Drive That Changes Our World. And if you've ever wanted to be entrepreneurial in the sense of running a nonprofit, of doing something in the social services sphere, as so many people in this town want to do.
Causes of the heart. And Park City's a better place, and the world's a better place because folks are driven by their heart.
100-plus nonprofits in Park City, and this story is for you and for all of those who want to do similar good deeds. So we will be talking with Paul Shoemaker in the first half hour.
Yeah, and the second half hour is going to be Matthew Wallman with San Francisco Design. San Francisco Design specializes in mountain modern design furnishings for your house. We're going to talk about what that means and how that's changed over the years. And speaking of changing over the years, they've had a quarter of a century in business. That's a long time. You see a lot of trends change, and you see a lot of the necessities to succeed in business change. So we're going to have a conversation with Matthew about that. And Larry, speaking of change, there's been a ton of change in what it takes to run a successful public radio station. And you and I are going to have a conversation after Matthew and talk about what it's been like for KPCW over 30-plus years.
Indeed. Media changing fast, so-called legacy media changing fast. And we will talk about that with our pledge drive now 1 week away from this morning. So all three of those conversations are coming up on Mountain Money, and we will begin after this.
This summer, tune into KPCW every Tuesday to join us for This Green Earth. We'll bring you the latest on all things environmental,
including extreme weather, melting sea ice, crazy wolverines, wild flowers, and sweaty polar bears.
All that every Tuesday at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by
Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Vail Resorts,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Being a member of the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business and provides a wide array of benefits. We promote your business, provide networking and educational opportunities, and even have benefit programs for you and your employees. For more information, visit us online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
And welcome back to Mountain Money, and we now have Paul Shoemaker on the line with us from Seattle. And no, we don't have Paul on the line with us. We have a dial tone. So we will work on getting Paul back online in just a few minutes. And in the meantime, Doug, we can talk about some other things in the news. Lots of headlines this morning. For one, the market this morning, really in the doldrums the last couple of weeks, but took off like a shot this morning.
Yeah, you know, there's a fair amount of uncertainty. People are trying to get their hands around what's happening out there. And the market, typically when there's uncertainty, you'll see increased volatility like we have recently. Long term, you know, I think if you're looking over 2 to 3 years, I think people will look back at this time and say, this was a pretty healthy time for the U.S. economy. The jobs report came out last Friday. And it's kind of in the Goldilocks range. It's not so strong that the Fed has to worry about wage inflation, but it's not weak that we have to worry, gee, are we doing an economy? So this slower than anybody would like, but predictable growth in the U.S., I think, is going to lay a foundation for some reasonable growth in the stock market over the next 2 to 3 years, certainly with lots of volatility like we've seen.
Okay, well, let's check in and see if we have Paul Shoemaker on the line with us now. Are you with us now, Paul?
Yes, gentlemen. Good morning.
Well, happy to hear from you. Excuse me. Let me clear my throat and we will begin. Your book is called Can't Not Do, which is kind of a double negative. An English teacher may cringe at that.
Mrs. McLaren, in fact, my eighth grader, she would shoot me.
And the subtitle is The Compelling Social Drive That Changes Our World. And let me tell folks a little bit about you. You're the founding president of Social Venture Partners International, a global network of thousands of social entrepreneurs, philanthropists, and business and community leaders in 39 cities and 8 countries. And as I said in the lead-in, Paul, Park City is a place where a lot of people come with and retire early and are go-getters, obviously, in their business life because they were able to retire early and still are involved in business. But they come here and they start nonprofits, and we have probably 100 nonprofit organizations that have sprung up in this little town over the past several decades. So there are a lot of social entrepreneurs in this town, and that's really what this book is about. Why don't you describe who it's for, why you wrote it?
Sure. So that book isn't necessarily to say start a nonprofit, but that spirit, that sort of entrepreneurial feeling those folks have is very much where I come from. There's a lot of folks like your listeners that reach sort of a point in their life where I think they, if you will, want to go from success to significance. And what I'm trying to do through the book is, because I spent 17 years hanging around with folks like that and they inspired the hell out of me, I finally decided to sort of write down what do I think not only did I learn from them to sort of inspire folks, but I thought would help either activate more folks or help folks that are on that pathway that you just described. So it's written for people that want to have an impact on the world and want to make some change in the world. But, you know, you don't have to be Bill Gates or Bono to do this. And we live in a time where we have a lot more money to solve problems. We have a lot more solutions to solve problems. And the ability for one person to have more of a potential positive impact in their community or around the world has never been greater. So that's the message I want to try to get to folks and have them understand. And again, also to understand that you don't have to be some superhero. That each person in their, you know, daily life, you could go start a new nonprofit. That's one way to do it. But you also could carve out a chunk of your life and a part of your time to go have a really significant impact. And the leverage that you can have and the impact that you can have with one person today has never been greater.
You know, one of the things that makes your book approachable is you tell the stories of people that have gone out and applied some of these concepts and served as a foundation for the frameworks that you describe. And I like sharing stories, so why don't we start with a couple of those stories? You start off your book with David Risher, so why don't we start off there? Tell us the story of David Risher.
Sure. Great example. He is a guy I had worked with in my professional life, and he, 7 or 8 years ago, was on a trip with his family, and it was one of those service trips. They were at an orphanage in Ecuador, and literally one day when they were doing whatever volunteer work that it was, and they sort of looked across the yard and saw this building with a locked door. And David asked the head of the orphanage what that was. And that person said, it's the library, but I think we've lost the key. And to most folks, you would just sort of think that's a bummer. In David's mind, he said, I just sort of like triggered something from him. But what it triggered for him was growing up, David was a guy that didn't have a lot. But what his mom and his parents really instilled in him was a love of reading, a love of books. So it's almost like, you know, sometimes every once in a while somebody has almost like an epiphanous moment. And for David, it was that way. It doesn't always play out that way. But for David, that locked door said to him, not, darn, that's a bummer. It said to him, what can I do about that? And the passion that he took off on was, how can I help affect illiteracy in third world countries around the world? So he created worldreader.org, which again, I'm not telling everybody to start a nonprofit, but David did. And what he spent the last several years of his life doing is focusing on how can I eradicate illiteracy around the world. And he's a guy that if you talk to him and you ask him about sort of the kids he's trying to help, for example, you would expect to hear, God, it's so hard for them and it's such a challenge. And what you hear from David is this, what I call determined optimism. He sees in those kids that he wants to help such a passion to learn, just like his own kid. Of course, they didn't grow up where his kids did,
sure.
But he said he sees the same passion in those kids' eyes that he sees in his own kids' eyes.
Now, the way you organize this book is asking seven questions. So let's, we may not get through them all, but let's start our way, ask some of those questions now and tell us how the person who will be inspired is or should be answering those questions.
You bet. So the first three questions I put in my book are, number one, what are you a determined optimist about? Number two, who are you at your core? And number three, what are you willing to go through hard places for? And obviously we don't have time to go in deep depth on each one of those. But what I've learned from those 17 years is, and what I try to do through the book is give people a way to really dive deep on each of those three questions. Each one of those has so much to it that if a person will sort of take the time to understand how they answer those questions, I think they can find that cause, that passion in life, what I call your can't not do, that really will inspire them and activate them. So in David's case, he was a determined optimist about helping kids in third world countries learn how to read. Who David is at his core is a guy that loves books, he loves learning, he loves to read. And in terms of going through hard places, this work takes him to all over Africa, into places that, you know, you could say he could go off and hang out in Park City and 365, 24/7, but he chooses not to. He chooses to sort of go out there in the world and go to those hard places, because if you're not willing to sort of go where it hurts and go where it's painful, you probably can't create real change. So those are the first three questions, and that's sort of, in a nutshell, how David answered them. And I try to, in the book, give people a way to really dig into each of those three questions to help them figure out what it is that they can't not do in the world.
You know, and by going to hard places, you're not necessarily talking about getting on a plane and flying to the third world and parachuting in for a week or two. And then going back to your cushy life, the hard place could be in downtown Salt Lake.
Right down by the Rhodes House. Absolutely.
Correct. And the idea of hard places is just that if you really want to be involved in community work, I'm not here to say it needs to be a drudge or it needs, you know, hurt all the time. But if we really want to do create change and, you know, let's say we want to change homelessness or we want to affect poverty, you need to sort of get close enough to the problem to feel it and to feel it hurt. And a lot of the folks that you work with, they're entrepreneurs, and we all know the story of the entrepreneur that built a business and the painful moments and the fail fast and the fail forward and the, and it's very much the hero's journey. Well, I want folks to understand that if you want to go create change, don't assume that it's supposed to be just an easy ride, that if you, whatever you learned about being a great entrepreneur and sort of trudging through the hard stuff, that's exactly the same mindset that I hope folks will take with them into their work to help change the community too.
Yeah, and I want to follow up, Larry, on your point about you don't have to go halfway across the world to do good. I had a chance to chat with a local businessman 6 months ago, Bryson Garbett. He's known for Garbett Homes in Utah. His passion is homelessness, and for years and maybe decades, he's donated to the cause, but always felt a little disconnected. And so his wife was on a long weekend with the girlfriends, and he decided, he went down to the local Goodwill store, got some beat up clothes, and decided to pretend to be homeless for a weekend.
Wow.
Including taking the public transportation to the homeless shelter, and spent two nights at the homeless shelter and spent time in that community, and really gave him some insights, what, 20 minutes from where we sit here today at the radio station, into this cause that he had been financially supporting, and was really a life-changing event. That's obviously, you know, a willingness to go to hard places. In some ways, he put himself a little bit in harm's way, so I'm not suggesting that for everybody. But it was a real eye-opening experience. And Paul, I want to ask you about what sparked this passion for you. You're the founding president of Social Venture Partners. I love the first sentence of about the author here. They say that you are the senior vice president, Seattle's executive connector for 17 years. And it sounds like you're really helping people that have this passion. How do they make that first step? First, how did you get this passion? And then when somebody comes to you and says, I want to make a difference in the Seattle area, how do you think about who and where to connect them?
Right. So I love your story, by the way. Had I known that, I probably should have put him in the book, or I'll follow up with you. That
sounds like that's your next. That's your sequel.
Yeah, that sounds like a great blog post. Seriously. So I spent 15 years in the private sector, and around sort of my mid to late 30s, sort of had this itch to scratch about getting more involved in my community. That's probably not an uncommon theme for your listeners. And for me, Social Venture Partners happened to come along, and there was a few people that were sort of the founding people of those ideas, a couple of tech entrepreneurs, Paul Brainerd, who founded all this, and Scott Oakey was a Microsoft guy. And my bet was on people. And if those two individuals created the idea, I thought, this is worth taking a jump for. So I did jump off, and I did start it. And what I was passionate about at the moment was to sort of do good in the world and help to build a new organization. What really became my deep passion was realizing that the greatest impact that I could have was through other people and working with other people. So that connector part of my title in the work that I do, and like so much of us, what all of us do in the world today, we're not directing much of anything. We're doing a lot of connecting. So because I've been at sort of the hub of this network, I've been able to connect lots of people that have lots of good ideas that otherwise might not connect up together and work together. And then when you do get the right folks together, 1 + 1 + 1 can equal 10. So my passion is about connecting the right people to their cause, their passion in the world. And the way to go about that, I mean, really in simple terms, number one, I would say to people, find a way to get directly engaged in your community beyond your money. And it might be volunteering, it might be working with other people, but go beyond your money. And then number two, find a peer network. It might be your friends, it might be your neighborhood, it might be an organization like Social Venture Partners. I know that when people get directly engaged in the work and when they get connected to other people, that is what gets them more and more active and has a more positive experience. And if you want more information about your local place, write to me on my website and I'd be glad to help somebody.
Good advice. Let's talk about some of the other questions that need answering. Are you ready to be humble and be humbled?
Yep. So the next three questions in the book are about, the first three are sort of about how do you define what I can't not do is for you. And the next three questions are about how does somebody show up to do this work. And for me, the idea of humility, and I don't mean sort of false humility here. I mean genuine humility, which is that if you show up and you want to work on a social cause, it isn't about you, it's about the work. It isn't about you, it's about the people that you want to help. And if you will bring that genuine, authentic attitude to it, it is such a powerful attractor. It's true in our business lives too, but it really, really shows up in this kind of work. And the idea of being willing to not only be humble, but to be humbled, sort of as an extension of hard places, you need to go into this work and come at it with an attitude that says, I know certain things, I don't know other things, and I'm probably going to get my rear end handed to me a couple of times before I really, truly understand what this is about. I need to be willing to be humble. So if I want to go work on a social cause, the example of your friend, Doug, is just amazing. How much more humbled can you get than being homeless for 2 days? The things that he must have felt, right? The way he must have experienced those couple of days, that's about as humbled as you can possibly get. And what I believe is not only is that going to do more for you as a person, what I think is it's a powerful attractor for people around you that also want to have an impact on that cause. So if you're humble about it, you will attract more people to your work and to your cause, and that way you'll be 10 times more powerful than you are yourself.
Let me ask you something that I've kind of struggled with myself, with my family, is, I think a lot of us attend churches that do different trips halfway around the world, and, somebody like myself that works in the stock market professionally, my handyman skills are quite limited. So if I went halfway across the world to help out at a village, I'm probably pounding nails and putting up drywall. And it's expensive to get somebody like me halfway across the world. And so the thing I've struggled with is, should I instead just donate that money to that village and let them pay somebody that's skilled at that probably is one-tenth the cost of getting me across the country, probably pay somebody 3 or 6 months' wages. On the other hand, we sent our 15-year-old daughter to India this summer to volunteer at a leprosy colony. because we wanted her to have that experience firsthand. So how do you balance maximizing the good that you do per dollar versus the life experiences?
Boy, what a great question. We could spend the whole, spend another hour on that. Just a couple of thoughts. The one is, as you said earlier, you don't have to go around the world. You can go down the block. And one thing I love about your example of that individual, by the way, is he works in housing and his focus is on homelessness. And it's just so connected to who he is and what he does. And what I would say to you is, number one, the value of going around the world, just like for your daughter, some of it obviously is what you can do for someone else and what she was trying to do in that leprosy colony. Number two, it's also what you learn and you get back from it yourself. And in your case, maybe you're not, maybe your highest value isn't with your hammers and your nails. Your greatest value may well be with your financial skills and your financial experience. And so volunteering in this world increasingly isn't just about hands-on, paint the wall, pound the nail. It's also about how do I use my head? How do I use my brain? Maybe I'm a strategic planner. Maybe I'm a marketing person. Maybe I'm a financial person. And nonprofits need financial skills. They need the side of skills you learned about how to watch businesses and see them grow and how money helps them grow. Nonprofits are small businesses. They just can't take their profits out for shareholders. So they need the same set of skill sets that you learned all those years of working markets. You need to learn a little translation. You need to learn a little experience. You need to practice a little humility when you apply those skills into the nonprofit world. But so many things you learned about money and business absolutely apply to nonprofits who need money to run their businesses.
Hey, Paul, we have just time for one last question, and let's answer the your question number seven. What is your can't not do? I mean, you talked a little bit about it. If you're a housing guy, maybe that's a great place to focus. If you're in financial, maybe that's where to focus. How do you know? Do you know instantly when you find your cause?
Great question. So for some folks, maybe you're like David Risher and you're sort of lucky and you have that epiphany. I think for many folks, it takes several years through life and it takes getting involved in nonprofit work and it's sort of a journey. For me, like I said to you, I took on my role. It took me sort of several years, I think, to understand. I wasn't just sort of trying to do good in the world. For me, my can't not do is that I've become, I hope, good at working with and helping people find that pathway, not just being inspired, but getting activated. So for me, it took me several years to sort of learn that. And it really came back to those same three questions that we started with at the start. I've sort of answered those things for myself. And what I'm trying to be good at in this world is helping other folks do that. And I've done that sort of day to day through SCP for 17 years. And now what I'm trying to do through this book is try to do that through a broader audience to more folks beyond the folks that I sort of work with day to day.
Well, that's a great answer, and it's a great question to wrap up on. But I do have one last question, and I paused doing this when Larry says it's the last question. He's the pro. I'm kind of his sidekick on the show. But I do think that there's a trend that I want people to hear about that we haven't discussed on the show yet. We've talked to a lot of venture capitalists, a lot of investors, but we haven't talked to many social venture partners. And I think that's an important trend that's taking place. Here in Park City, there's a group called Impact Investment Leaders.
Yep.
They're also known as Purpose Investment Network. And I think that's a trend that I want to introduce to Park City. And Paul, could you share with the audience, what is social venture investing and how is it different than typical venture investing?
Sure. So Kurt and the guys at Impact Investment Leaders, they're actually part of the SCP network. So the idea of impact investing is in simple that there are for-profit ideas that also can have a social purpose. So nonprofit, for-profit, sometimes folks think that's a mission thing. It's not. It's just a source of capital. So if you can make money doing good in this world, for Pete's sake, do it. Not everything works that way. That's why we have a nonprofit sector. But there are more and more folks sort of involved in what we call impact investing, looking for social purpose for-profit organizations to make debt, equity, different kinds of investments in it, expecting some amount or a lot of financial return. It just sort of opens up a whole new source of capital and a new way of thinking about solving social problems. It's exciting to me because it's new approaches and it's new capital applied to social problems. And the guys that you work with in Utah there, Kurt and company, they're great.
Well, that's a good note for us to wrap on, and thanks for introducing that concept. I hope it's something that we talk about in the future on this show as well. Our guest this morning has been Paul Shoemaker. He is the author of Can't Not Do, The Compelling Social Drive That Changes Our World. Paul, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, gentlemen.
And we are heading into break, and let you know that we're supposed to hit 80 degrees today in Park City, probably add about 5 degrees to that for the Heber Valley. We are in a pattern now. It's late, hate to say late summer. Let's not say it's late summer. Let's say it's a mid-August pattern now of afternoon thunderstorms cropping up from time to time, especially later in the week. Should be 77 to 80 degrees and mostly sunny all week long, but all week we need to look out for afternoon thunderstorms. Well, when we come back, we are going to talk with Matt Wallman of San Francisco Design about design and being in the business here in Park City now for a quarter century. Mountain Money will continue after this.
Assemble is proud to be a KPCW underwriter. Assemble offers executive offices which can be rented on a long or short-term basis, or a business lounge membership located in New Park. More information on the web at assembleparkcity.com or 435-709-7888.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home. Hi, I'm Matt from Sanford.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Enjoyed that conversation with Paul Shoemaker and talking about doing good and things you can't not do and social venture investing. That was a great conversation. In studio with us now is Matthew Wallman. He is one of the owners of San Francisco Designs, also a generous supporter of Mountain Money and KPCW, which we really appreciate your support. Matt, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we were just talking in the green room about San Francisco Designs, 25 years in Park City, sounds like 30-plus years also in Salt Lake City. What was the start of the company? How did your family get involved in San Francisco Designs?
Well, my mother actually started the business. She started working in retail furniture, actually right here in Salt Lake, moved to San Francisco when my dad got a job there, and really got turned on by the business and liked design, and they knew they wanted to start a family here in Utah, and came back and ultimately opened their store. But there really wasn't any contemporary or modern furniture places in Salt Lake, so they saw that void and wanted to fill it.
And in Salt Lake, you're on Highland Drive, along with many other furniture stores. There's kind of a cluster. You can go from store to store and see different designs. And describe the style, because one thing that's interesting is that you have two stores and really two reflecting two different design aesthetics.
Absolutely. Our Salt Lake location is in a perfect spot right on Highland Drive and kind of what we call Furniture Row down there. And in Salt Lake, you're going to get a lot more contemporary furnishings, a little bit more edge to it. That's what the Salt Lake clientele are looking for. And in Park City, you're going to get a little bit of that, but it's going to be with rustic overtones, distressed leathers. But interestingly enough, in the past probably 5 years, we've seen a change in what our clients are looking for in Park City into what we call mountain modern. And you're going to see a lot more clean lines, a lot of organic colors in there. Traditionally, Park City homes have been trying to take nature and put it into the home, and we're still doing that, but now we're introducing steel, a little bit more edge to it, you know, textures, different colors, things like that.
And you see that in architecture too. It's been stone and timber with log accents in the homes of Park City as they're being built. But now you're seeing more straight lines and exposed concrete and steel and glass. So I guess the furniture is a reflection of the architecture.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the things with our designers, they've been trying to do that for years, trying to reflect our Salt Lake store, and it's finally kicked in up in Park City. It's really nice to see, and it's nice to work with some architects in town to create a total concept of the home.
So the furniture business is a tough business. My company's down in Sugar House, right down the street from Granite Furniture, whose day had come and gone. And there's lots of furniture stores that thrive for a while, and then they miss a trend, and they're not around. If you think back 30 years ago when your mom opened the first store in Salt Lake City, I mean, that was 1985. That was, you know, the Macintosh computer had just been introduced. Most people were still writing commands in the DOS line of their home computers, if they even had one. So think about how much the world has changed in 30 years. Why do you think San Francisco Designs has been able to stay on the forefront, stay relevant, and succeed through, you know, what must have been probably 10 major design changes?
Well, really, it's our focus on customer service. I truly believe that, and that's part of our vision. Design trends can change at the drop of a hat, but really what we think people are looking for is a total experience. They're not necessarily buying furniture. They're buying a feeling, you know, how they want their home to look. So that's what we're trying to provide, not only with our design service, but our delivery, our follow-up, things like that. I really think our customer service is what sets us apart from everybody else.
Well, it must, right? 30 years in business successfully, so that's got to be a key core to helping out there. So congratulations to you and your family for that.
Thank you very much. And, you know, with the internet, it's even more, we're putting more focus into our customer service.
Let's talk about design service, because you're not, you know, I guess R.C. Willie is the obvious example. You're not walking into a store and saying, I like that couch, deliver it next Tuesday. Yours is it's more, I mean, you'll certainly sell a couch if that's what someone wants, but what you're doing is taking a look at the whole house and designing a look and feel.
Absolutely. We're kind of a hybrid. It's an interesting model that we have. Every salesperson on staff is an accredited interior designer. So when people come into our showroom, the first question is not, what are you looking for? It's, you know, welcome, what can we help you, or what can we help you achieve today, or over a long period of time? And that's the big difference. Our goal is not to sell you one sofa. Our goal is to help you furnish your dream home.
And do you sometimes then start at the architectural stage when it's on paper?
We will do that. We look at design plans pretty much daily. Sometimes we'll work with the architect. Most of the time, that's already taken place. But then we'll come back to the design plans and figure out how to finish the room, accessorize it the right way. A lot of the times, people walk into our showrooms, and we've set them up in such a way where they look beautiful. We want to convey that to the client, that you can't just buy something and it's going to look the same way in the showroom. So we have to do accessories, matching patterns, matching the living room to the kitchen, things like that. So it all flows nicely.
And it then is a lot of the furniture custom made rather than off the shelf, out of the warehouse type furniture?
Yeah, I would say about 70% of our business is custom furniture. We try to use local brands as much as we can, or certainly Made in America is a big part of our business. American companies do business the right way, we think. Sustainable furniture is something we really look forward to, whether it's getting wood from tree farms or organic fabrics, things like that. And it seems like the American companies are doing that. We try to limit our exposure to Asia as much as we can in that way.
And so, Matt, you're a young man. I'm imagining you grew up in the business as a young boy. Talk about your journey with San Francisco Designs and whether you worked outside of the family business for a while and came back, and if so, what was the draw? Why did you decide to come back?
Well, growing up, actually, I didn't have much exposure to the business.
I would have thought you were back in the warehouse schlepping sofas.
I did do a little bit of that. However, I grew up ski racing, so I was quite busy with that. I went to...
the right town for that,
too. Yeah, exactly. I got recruited to ski for the University of New Hampshire and actually stayed back east 2.5 years after college. Worked in Boston in finance, and was looking to go to law school. And my mom said, all right, before you do that, before you spend all that money to go to law school, come back and see if you, you know, just try working in the business, because we've built this up and we don't want to sell it, or we want to see if you want to continue it, but no pressure. And I came back and I actually worked on the sales floor down in Salt Lake, and I just fell in love with it. I really like the process, and I love talking to people. I mean, that's probably my favorite part of the job. Half the time, I'm making coffee for people down in...
You know, when you go to the Highland store and the Park City store, but our most recent experience shopping was on Highland Drive. It was, can I get you something to drink? And we have some fresh cookies, and so it's a pretty welcoming experience.
Yeah, it's... We want you to walk in and think you're walking into our home. We really want to treat you like that. So many times I walk into different showrooms. It doesn't matter if it's furniture. It could be jewelry or something like that. And it's, what are you looking for? Or sometimes it's, I even get ignored. So I'm really conscious of that. And that's why we do offer the cookies and coffee and lemonade in the summer. Just a different shopping experience we're trying to convey.
And how's the business different maybe today? You mentioned the internet. How important is that piece of your business? And can you see a day where that becomes the majority of your business?
Luckily for us, the internet is big in terms of getting eyeballs to our website and then ultimately to our showroom. We are starting to dabble in internet sales, more so for accessories, lamps, things like that. However, we found that when shopping online, it's very hard to tell if it's a quality piece or not. So often it's all about price. So a lot of our clients have said, I've tried to buy online, I got it in my house, and I hated it. So that's where we get an advantage over internet retailers.
There's a lot of barriers to shopping for furniture over the internet. I know a number of folks have tried to set up big businesses on the internet selling furniture, and to my knowledge, none of them have really been able to figure out how to make it happen.
I remember,
you want to sit on the couch, yeah, and make sure it's comfortable.
I remember in the early days when people were jumping on, grabbing domain names, some company got furniture.com, and then they spent millions having a search engine that let you change the fabric on the thing, and they never once looked at what it cost to ship a couch from North Carolina to Seattle or wherever. And at that point, the whole business crumbled because they couldn't deliver furniture one piece at a time. It's a rather obvious part of the business that was ignored, and that's kind of what makes furniture shopping, unless it's a broken down piece that's in a box like you'd get at IKEA, a hard thing to do.
Yeah, it really is. And we're constantly looking over our logistics as well. And we're shipping quite a bit of furniture to our warehouse. And it's even managing our costs and keeping prices down as much as we can. So I can't imagine with the big internet retailers how they do it. I mean, a lot of what we see out there is free shipping, but it's you don't know what you're getting. You don't know if it's going to be a curbside delivery or
and free
in-home.
Isn't free. It's
no,
built
it's
into
not.
The price anyway.
Absolutely.
And what about the next layer? We talked about your suppliers and working to buy from American manufacturers. Boy, there for a while, it seemed like so much of the furniture business was going to Asia, was going overseas. I was in Wisconsin a couple weeks ago. There's a big company there, Master Locks, that's based there, and they were celebrating that Master Locks was starting to bring jobs back from China, back to the U.S. Are you seeing that in the furniture business? Are those suppliers, are those manufacturers, U.S. manufacturers, getting healthier and stronger?
Absolutely. We've seen that for probably 4 years now. I think after the recession, there was a lot of panic going on, and it was a race to the bottom in terms of what people could provide. And a lot of that was going over to Asia, even switching from China to Vietnam to produce to get even lower prices. But then about 4 years ago, we saw a lot of companies come back over and try to hire, especially in the North Carolina region, skilled artisans again. So, and now even we're hearing from our suppliers that it's tough to find work because there is so many of the companies have come back to the United States. So it's nice to see.
Good to know. Well, congratulations on 25 years in business in Park City, 35 overall in Salt Lake, San Francisco Design. Great local company, great local family, the Wallmans. Matt Wallman, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Happy to be here.
Okay. And when we come back, Doug and I are going to dissect some of the stories in the news today and talk a little bit about the business of public broadcasting after this.
Hi, my name is Michaela Wilkeson, and by the time I'm 35, I want to meet every single Avenger.
Over the past 35 years, KPCW has grown up with this town and reported all of the challenges, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Help us continue to grow for another 35 years by participating in the KPCW Summer Pledge Drive, August 17th through 21st. We're kicking off the pledge drive with our Transportation Hour and premiums from Lewis Stages, All Resort Express, and Park City Transportation.
Hello, I'm Justin Keyes. As an attorney in the Park City office of Jones Waldo, I'm pleased to support Mountain Money on KPCW. Our firm provides construction, real estate, and general business legal services to the Park City community. We are online at joneswaldo.com and can be reached at 435-200-0085.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. We have about 10 minutes left, and we don't, Doug, often have enough time to just catch up on interesting things that have been in the news. And
there's no shortage of it recently.
I thought we'd just take a few minutes to do that. And one thing that happened over the weekend, late Friday, this is a Delta town, as you know. Hundreds of pilots and flight attendants and executives live in Park City and have ever since the second largest of their pilot hubs moved here. And a plane flying Boston to Salt Lake Friday night, as it got towards Salt Lake, hit just a hellacious thunderstorm. And the pictures of it are just frightening. And the pilots diverted to
Denver
think, yeah. And landed safely. And someone who heard the transcripts of the conversation or heard a recording of the conversation said it just sounded like the pilots were ordering a double latte.
Calm and cool.
At a coffee shop. And when you look at the pictures, the front nose cone is caved in. It's inverted.
And the windshield
And the windshield was just smashed to pieces.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to the safety of the commercial aircraft industry and the training of organizations like Delta for their pilots. I'm a pilot myself, as you know. That was a very rare storm that they went through. They encountered hail. That's where the damage came from. You know, what I was really encouraged by is, as you look at that, A, they were able to land the plane safely. Why? Because they have all this automated equipment. Plus, you think about it, pilots oftentimes during bad weather will land without being able to see outside the window till the last 200, 300 feet. And they now have technologies in the airplane that'll take it down that last 200 feet. So, you know, almost all the passengers were fine. There was one that was taken into the hospital for cuts and bruises. And likely that was caused by something in the cabin, somebody's laptop or something, when you hit turbulence, it starts flying around. So these aircraft are very, very safe. I know some people have a fear of flying. What I would say is you're more likely to get struck by lightning or attacked by a wild hog than you are to have a problem on a commercial flight.
Yeah, there are wild hog attacks just happening left and right.
I have a unreasonable phobia of sharks, but yet I like to surf. And one of the things that gives me peace of mind in the ocean is I read a statistic: I am more likely to be attacked by a hog than I am a shark.
Okay.
So when I'm out there and I see a fin come up because it's a dolphin nearby, I think about that and it gives me peace of mind.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump because he's just kind of upset the Republican race, leading it, and he's bragging about his business acumen and about how America is bankrupt and it takes a businessman to put things back together, and he's the kind of hard-charging businessman America needs. But he's had four bankruptcies.
He has, yeah. Now, he has a plethora of businesses, so I don't know percentage-wise, but I suspect that that's low. You know, overall, I think people would say Donald Trump is a successful businessman. And so I think, yeah, the bankruptcies are a blemish on his track record. I think the governor from Ohio,
John Kasich.
I think he gave a really good answer during the debate where he said, you know, Donald Trump has struck a chord in the Republican Party about people wanting change and wanting straight answers. And I think, A, that was a diplomatic answer, and B, I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Indeed.
Don't you?
Yeah. Absolutely. Another favorite subject of ours is technology here on the show, and we talk to the Consumer Reports car guys quite frequently because they've got some interesting takes on one of the biggest businesses in America making cars. And we were both struck by the fact that the last time we talked to the car editor there, he said the most perfect car that's ever been made is the Tesla. And
perfect 10, right?
And perfect 10. And he said if the scale went to 11, they'd give it an 11. It is such a perfect car. But I read over the weekend, Tesla loses money on every car it sells. How can that continue?
Yeah, well, as you know, it cannot continue, right? So they're hoping to make it up with volume. And one of the reasons Tesla stock was down last week.
How do you make it up with volume? That just means you lose more.
There's such high fixed costs with producing cars. So they're doing they're on a run rate about 50,000 cars every 12 months. And you can see if you can amortize that fixed cost over 100,000 cars. Where they could start making profits. So, you know, what Elon Musk has done, I'm actually reading a biography on Elon Musk right now. Fascinating guy. And what in particular really impresses me is he's taken on big, big challenges. When you think about space.
Space. Battery cars is not even the most technically challenging thing.
Making a car is really, really hard. And the way he's choosing to do it is impossible. And I'm quite impressed with what he's pulled off. And I'm waiting for the used market to get such. I've never bought a new car. It's just not who I am. I don't like the idea of driving it off the lot and losing 20-25% of its value. So I'm waiting for the day where the used Teslas are such that I'm willing to pay the price because they are great cars.
Yeah, and part of what he's banking on for profitability is to bring out a lower-cost car. He's looking at a not exactly a car for every man. It's still going to be in the $30,000 or $40,000 range, but that's half of what they are now. They're pretty much all in the 80s now.
As you and Carol look at your future and the future cars that you'd like to have, do you envision having any electric car sometime in the next 10 years?
I would like to. There just isn't one that serves my parameters right now.
Because of the mileage you drive?
Because of the mileage driven And I'm looking for an SUV. There just aren't a lot of electric SUVs out there.
The SUV's coming out later this year, so and, just hang on a couple months.
Okay, I will. And then the price has to come down from the 80-ish range as well. Let's also talk about public radio. Our pledge drive, KPCW, twice a year comes to the listener and asks for support, and we will be doing so next week again. And always an exciting time around here because there's just a ton of energy, and we feed off the calls we get. And I think, you know, if you watch a lot of public television, you can get a little frustrated with all the bebop music shows that are designed around pledge drives, and there are an awful lot of them. And even in Salt Lake, the NPR pledge drives for the stations down there are pretty staid, but you can't say that about a KPCW pledge drive.
No, they're a lot of fun, and you guys do a great job. And I want to remind the audience, and Larry, you'll have to refresh my memory on the percentages, but a significant part of the operating budget, and you guys run on a shoestring here, but a significant part of the operating budget does come from our listening public.
It is about 25%.
Yeah.
And we run on a budget of about $1 million. It was about in the 700s when I got here at the depth of the recession, and we were in, we were having a bit of a tough time. But thanks to a booming economy, we are back up to where the budget is about $1 million, and 25% of it, $250,000, needs to come from listeners. And although we certainly encourage donations year-round, and we encourage sustaining donors who are here who agree to give us money monthly out of their charge card or out of their checking account. It is really during the two pledge drives when we really directly ask that we receive most of our donation income.
Yeah, and let me ask you, at its high, I think a lot of people think public radio is funded by the government. And there may have been a day where that was partly true, but it's getting less and less true. At its high, what percent of the station's budget was funded by government sources, and what is that today?
Well, I can only think back to my tenure here, and it was 17-18% of the budget. And we've been trying to reduce it because Congress has been somewhat impatient with public radio, saying, you know, it's time you guys survive on your own. And there have been a number of laws that have passed the House and usually have been stopped in the Senate, defunding public radio in its entirety, public broadcasting in its entirety. And that's when Big Bird shows up on Capitol Hill,
right,
and
exactly.
Says, "Don't kill Big Bird." So we've been trying to wean ourselves, trying to grow our local revenue sources, so that we are less dependent, so if that day does come, that we're not in a panic over it. And we have reduced down to about 12% now of our revenue from 18% comes from our Corporation for Public Broadcasting grant. Now, that money is not unrestricted. We can't do whatever we want with those funds. What Congress wanted to do with their grants is create a robust marketplace of ideas. And that means we have to return a percentage of our grant to national programmers. So we buy programming from American Public Media, we buy programming from Public Radio International, and we buy programming from National Public Radio, NPR. And that money goes back to those sources for the national
programming. Loves those programmings, but the thing that they love the most is the local programming that we do and keeping folks informed. Last week when I was driving in, there was a power outage, and you could hear the generator going in the back of the KPCW studios. You were one of the few folks that had power and could get the word out and let the audience know what was going on.
Yeah, and people have battery radios, so or they go out to their car and they can still hear us. So it's important that we keep vital information flowing and staff to do it. Well, that's going to wrap up Mountain Money for this morning. I want to thank our great sponsors, Mountain West Bank, the Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. And our great guest, Paul Shoemaker, author of Can't Not Do, The Compelling Social Drive That Changes Our World, and Matt Wallman from San Francisco Design. That's it. This is KPCW Park City.